This is the BBC calling the world from London.
...50 years ago since it started, and practically everyone of my generation remembers that beginning. Since the turn of the century, Morse code had been dot-dashing its way through the air, and in 1906, an American called Fessenden had transmitted music and speech across several hundred miles of ocean. Then suddenly, in 1922, this British Broadcasting Company was set up, and soon all our fathers and uncles and schoolboy friends had become what was known as listeners. Very simple, quite cheap. You rigged a long piece of wire between a curtain pole and your chimney pot with two cotton reels to act as insulators. That was the aerial. You took a metal bicycle pump to act as a condenser. You pinched two lead soldiers from your small brother, melted them down over the fire, tossed in a handful of flowers of sulfur, and produced what was called a crystal. You bought a pair of headphones, very expensive these, 25 bob at least, stamped with the words BBC, which is how the BBC, licensed by the post office, made its money. You fiddled about, touching the crystal with a bit of thin wire called a cat's whisker, and suddenly there in your headphones was the voice of a man called Peter Eckersley, making the first regular broadcasts in British history.
Hello, CQ. This is 2 Emma Talk, Rittle testing. This is 2 Emma Talk, Rittle testing. Hello, CQ. Hello. Hello, Ash. Hello, Ash. Ash, hello. Are the signals okay? Wave your hand if it's all okay. Hello, CQ. Hello, CQ. This is 2 Emma Talk, Rittle testing. This is 2 Emma Talk, Rittle testing.
And very soon, if that wasn't satisfying enough... There was something quite splendid about that early reception. We all felt we were pioneers. We knew we'd experienced a memorable moment in human history. There were the Savoy Orpheans banging away in our eardrums, or perhaps it was the Savoy Havana Band, bringing back all those memories of the seaside and pierrots and comics in straw boaters and striped blazers. Politicians and newspaper editorials made the usual portentous remarks about the influence of the new medium, how necessary it was to see we didn't fall into the same commercial radio trap as the Americans, who'd made wireless a marvellous medium for soap ads and soap operas. Lord Gainford at the opening of BBC Savoy Hill in 1923.
Last year, the manufacturers of wireless apparatus met together by invitation of the post office. As it was realized that broadcasting would have to be controlled by one broadcasting authority if the chaos which today is so obvious in America were to be avoided here. I want you to understand that in addition to trying to protect our 600 manufacturing members, we have never lost sight of the interests of the general public.
I don't think most of us were all that concerned, just fascinated by the noises. Certainly not as concerned as the first general manager of the BBC, a tall, dark, gaunt Presbyterian Scot named John Reith, with a scar down his face, soon to acquire an authority envied by press, parliament and clergy, who said firmly that to exploit so great a scientific invention for the purpose and pursuit of entertainment alone would be a prostitution of its powers and an insult to the character and intelligence of the people. So Auntie BBC had started her original though chartered, career. A fine blaze of news bulletins, plays, talks, features. The first opera, Il Trovatore, broadcast from Birmingham in 1923. By the end of 1924, radio and the BBC were as firmly fixed in the British way of life as a cup of tea and the Houses of Parliament.
Put on your earphones, tune on your set, listen in at 3:30. Sit well back, we're going to have a crack from Auntie Aggie of the BBC.
A million radio licenses were issued. You could buy radio sets with horns or in cabinets. Old music hall artists like Harry Lauder were making debuts which were almost farewell performances.
I love a laddie, a bonnie, bonnie laddie. She's as pure as the lily in the dell. She's as sweet as the heather, the bonnie purple heather. Mary, my Scotch bluebell. I love a laddie.
In those dewy days of early radio, there was probably just as much invention as there is today. Who but a genius or a nut could have induced Beatrice Harrison to sit in the middle of a Surrey wood playing Songs My Mother Taught Me on the cello to induce the nightingales to sing? On July the 5th, 1926, the audience were possibly enthralled by the first broadcast from under the Thames by a diver. More probably, they enjoyed the first ever London radio dance band, conducted by Sidney Furman, who played twice a week throughout that year.
Step on the heebies, step on the jeebies, then we'll do the dance. That heebie-jeebie, grab your girlie, grab your boy. It just fills you full of joy. If you don't know it, come on, we'll show it. It is something new. Come on, we teach you, step right up. Let's take a chance and do that heebie-jeebie, friends. Come on and do it, do that heebie-jeebie dance.
In 1924, the pin-up storyteller of our father's era was A.J. Allen.
Good evening, everyone. This is A.J. Allen. I remember one night in 1923, I'd been to Savoy Hill, telling some story or other, and afterwards I was sitting in what they call the drawing room, having a having a yarn with the announcer. While we were talking, the commissioner put his head in at the door, and he said, I think you ought to know, Mr. Allen, that there's some people outside waiting to take your photograph. So we peeped through the window curtains, and there they were, four or five of them, and they got a blooming great camera on a tripod and flashlight apparatus and goodness knows what. And I thought, oh, I'd rather like to watch this. So I went out by quite another door, much higher up the street, and wandered down and joined the group. And after a bit, I saw them take an excellent photograph of the announcer when he came out. And I know it was jolly good, because when I autographed it a few days later, everyone said it was the image of him. Good night, everyone.
Every producer quickly realized he had this ace up his sleeve, the drama of the spoken word, which added a new dimension to the event. Dr. Howard Carter, who first peered into Tutankhamun's tomb.
With intense excitement, I went forward and unbolted the inner door. They slowly swung open, and there, filling the entire area within, stood an immense yellow quartzite sarcophagus. It effectually barred any further progress until we could raise the lid. Then a decisive moment. None of us but felt the solemnity of the occasion. In a dead silence, the huge lid, weighing over a ton and a quarter, was raised from its bed. Light shone into the sarcophagus. The contents were completely covered by linen shrouds. But as the last shroud was rolled back, a gasp of wonderment escaped our lips. So gorgeous was the sight that met our eyes. A golden effigy of the young king of magnificent workmanship filled the whole of the interior. This was but the lid of a series of three coffins nested one within the other, enclosing the mortal remains of the young King Tutankhamun.
Carter's discovery allowed us to listen to the trumpets which had first sounded 3,000 years before. Radio, of course, produced its new techniques. Who would have thought that today's trendy disc jockeys were started in 1927 by a quiet, conservative gent named Christopher Stone?
Good afternoon. Well, I'd like to be able to bring this bunch of records to you. And then I'd see from the look on your face whether each one pleased you or bored you. Songs, for instance, that we've heard so often, sung by our friends or by professional artists or played by bands or broadcast, do they still come to your mind with a fragrance of memory?
Even in those days, only our elders found this swinging. And the bizarre name of Pop was not even a quaver in Albert Sandler's eye. Thank you. The auntie image, and a rather strictly brought-up religious auntie at that, persisted all through the 20s and 30s. The very first padre of early radio was the Reverend J.A. Mayo, rector of Whitechapel, in 1922.
This is 2LO calling. The Reverend John Mayo, the rector of Whitechapel, is going to give you a short address.
I have just come from my church in Whitechapel, a great church situated in the midst of all the noise and the turmoil and the dust and the slums and all that Whitechapel connotes. And it is my privilege, by the aid of the wizardry of Mr. Marconi in this wonderful house, to speak, as I understand, to many thousands of people. Surely no man has ever proclaimed the gospel from such an extraordinary pulpit as I am now occupying. Having preached sometimes in cathedrals and sometimes in the kitchen of a doss house, I notice one great difference here. Whether in the cathedral or the doss house, I could at any rate see my audience. Here I cannot.
It was in 1926 when the general strike began that the BBC first took up its national role. It was the only communication channel available to keep the nation in touch. In some ways, its news reporting of the event sounds a little odd by today's standards.
Here is the last news bulletin for today. The following items of news indicate the general situation in the country. Copyright in these items is reserved outside the British Isles. At the High Mass in Westminster Cathedral today, His Eminence Cardinal Bourne made the following declaration. The time through which we are now passing is of exceptional character, and the present strike is of a nature quite unlike the many others which have preceded it. It is necessary that the Catholics should have clearly before their minds the moral principles which are involved. There is no moral justification for a general strike of this character. It is a direct challenge to a lawfully constituted authority and inflicts, without adequate reason, immense discomfort and injury on millions of our fellow countrymen. It is therefore a sin against the obedience which we owe to God, who is the source of that authority, and against the charity and brotherly love which we... Mr. A.J. Cook, the miners' leader, said, "Let us show that we know how to maintain order. We have instructed our men to do their own police work. And from John O'Groats to Land's End, our men are organizing themselves. A drunken man, a rowdy man, is your enemy and mine. If I had my way, I would shut every pub down. We need clear heads in this struggle."
The world's headlines in the 20s and 30s were full of firsts. First to fly across the Atlantic, first to do this or that. Pioneer airman Sir Alan Cobham remembers a period of aviation history which we shall certainly never experience again.
I went out the old route, you know, down through, crossed down across France on a seaplane and landed at Marseille and then on to Athens, and then I hopped over the land and landed on the Tigris and straight on down to Basra and landed on the Tigris again and then down the Persian Gulf in terrible conditions on rough seas, and the Karachi, and went across the rivers of India. But of course, you know, at Basra, poor old Elliot was shot by an Arab while we were flying at about 50 feet in a sandstorm. That was a sad story. However, they gave me another man, the Air Force, Sergeant Ward, and I carried on from there. And we got through India, and we were lucky on the outward journey to escape the monsoon. We just got in between it, down to Singapore via Rangoon and Moulmein. Then from Singapore we came straight on along to Java and straight on then to Bali and through Bali to Kupang and across to Darwin. And I flew the whole journey over this dreaded sea that they talk so much about, a journey of about 400 or 500 miles at about 25 feet against a 20 to 30 mile an hour headwind. And we were only too lucky, you know, to just hit up on Bathurst Point. And so we made it. And there we took our undercarriage off, met by the Australian Navy, and flew as an aeroplane all around Australia. Came back again, put our floats on, and got back home.
By the late 20s, the BBC were capitalising on their ability to bring you events as they happened. Boat races, football finals, grand nationals. And in the 30s, Heavyweight Championships, direct from New York.
Once again, he jumps into Lewis and swings a punch at him. Lewis gets away from it and shoots short right to left jabs to Tommy's face. Tommy goes back and hammers him about the body. Far hammered, Lewis about the body then. They've broken away, and they're fighting him out there in the center of the ring. It's a real good round. Far jumping into Lewis again. Long left to the side of Lewis's head. Another left to Lewis's head, and he swings that right over to Lewis's head. He's driving Lewis back against the rope. Far's driving Lewis back against the rope, and they're swinging away at each other, and they're going hard at each other. Far jumps into him, and he's crashing blows at Lewis. Far's jumping at Lewis, bombarding Lewis with blows. There's the bell for the end of the fight. There's the bell for the end of the fight. And they're giving Farr a great ovation. Here's the announcement.
The winner and still champion, Lewis.
Joe Lewis wins. Joe Lewis wins on a decision.
In 1928, the first resident dance band, the BBC Dance Orchestra, under Jack Payne. Into our homes came the voices of politicians. Stanley Baldwin.
We have gone a long way since the dark days of last autumn. We are now weathering the world depression better than any other country in the world. But much remains to be done. One of the obstacles is the burden of taxation. The country has decided once and for all that the budget must be balanced, whatever sacrifices are entailed.
Ramsay MacDonald.
They saw a big deficit in prospect. They said that we have been borrowing for current expenditure. They fear that we are living beyond our means and may continue to do so, and that we are no longer exporting enough to pay for our necessary and very large imports of food and raw materials.
Writers, H.G. Wells.
Everywhere today, we have a sense of change about us, such as the world never felt before. Our economic life is manifestly out of gear, very seriously out of gear. There has been a creeping paralysis of business for some years. We are overproducing and underconsuming. Our political life is out of gear, even more than our economic life. We are taxed overwhelmingly, crushingly, to pay for the last war and to prepare for the next.
Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
Radio comedy had started with the beginnings of the BBC, though probably the first of them made famous by the medium were Vivian Foster and John Henry.
John Henry, darling.
Yes, oh moon of my delight.
Do you remember those happy days when we were courting?
I shall never forget them. And do you remember how we walked along by the side of the sea, the wild, restless, tumultuous, untamable sea, and you said it always reminded you of me?
Yes, I remember, John Henry. And would you like to know why you reminded me of the wild, restless, tumultuous, untamable sea?
Yes.
Because you made me sick.
Later, there was Rob Wilton, Gilly Potter.
After the fireworks had failed to go off, in the absence of anyone wishing to do so, Lord Marshmallow proposed himself a hearty vote of thanks. It was all so very English. Waiting a while to see if anyone would second the proposal, he did so himself. And since no one came forward to carry the proposal into actuality, he then gave himself three hearty cheers. It was all so English.
King George V and the Prince of Wales had spoken on radio as early as 1924 at Wembley's Empire Exhibition. But in 1932, the BBC started a programme to fit a new royal and radio occasion. The Christmas Day Commonwealth Roundup programme came to its climax when George V spoke to his scattered subjects.
Through one of the marvels of modern science, I am enabled this Christmas Day to speak to all my peoples throughout the empire. I take it as a good omen that wireless should have reached its present perfection at a time when the empire has been linked in closer union. For it offers us immense possibilities to make that union closer still. It may be that our future will lay upon us more than one stern step. Our past will have taught us how to meet it unshaken. My life's aim has been to serve, as I might, towards those ends. Your loyalty, your confidence in me has been my abundant reward. I speak now from my home and from my heart to you all. To men and women so cut off by the snows, the desert, or the sea, that only voices out of the air can reach them. To all, I wish a happy Christmas. God bless you.